Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, this week we mark the passing of one of Israel's great songwriters, singers, Tzvika Pick. And it comes at quite the time, right? Because you were just educating me a bit about his music and told me about one song, Ahava B'Sof HaKaitz, Love at the End of the Summer. And that's kind of where we are right now, as the summer winds down. But Lahav, beyond what I know, which is that his son-in-law is Quentin Tarantino, what was Tzvika Pick to the state of Israel?
You know, he brought, I think, a different kind of music to Israel at a time when Israel was just starting to break out of this whole pattern of all the most popular songs in Israel were written by army military bands and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, you had sort of rock bands, and then he brought in the pop, and just like he brought kind of disco to Israel, I would say, but it's more than just disco. Like the pop songs have lasted, you know, here we are almost 50 years after he had his biggest hits, and you still hear them on the radio all the time. And just as a major songwriter, like he wrote huge hits of like the late 70s, early 80s, and even in the 90s when Israel won the Eurovision for the song Diva by Donna International, like he wrote that. Mm-hmm. He's just ubiquitous. You know, his music is just everywhere in Israel, considered like just classics. And I think you really just saw throughout the country that people were just sad to see him go. You know, he was this like eccentric figure. He kept his hair long well into old age, well into it looking scraggly and not like a cool disco star. And he had this nickname, the Maestro. He was just like a very fun artist.
A fun artist with great lyrics and a great tune to just one of his classics, Ahava B'Sof HaKaitz. Lahav, you mentioned that some of the songs before Tzvika Pick were the military band. So speaking of the military, we saw another general throw his hat into the political ring this week. Gadi Eisenkot, the former chief of staff, the man who succeeded Benny Gantz as chief of staff and preceded the current chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, has decided now to enter politics. He decided to join the party that is led by Benny Gantz. And I wanted to get your take on Gadi Eisenkot and the significance of him joining. But I do think it's just important to point out to our listeners the different iterations of Benny Gantz and his party since he joined politics just under 3 years ago, right? First, remember, his first party was
Israel Resilience.
And remember, the color was green, right? It was all about the army and, like, you know, the military.
That was all he had going for him.
Right, that's all he had going for him. Remember that video he did about how many Arabs he killed? Remember, like, that was his, like, big thing?
That was really weird, yeah.
Very strange. So Israel Resilience was the first thing. Then he joined with Telem, which was led by the former chief of staff, Bogi Yalon, so became Israel Resilience Telem. Then the third was when Lapid merged with him, so it became from Israel Resilience and Yesh Atid, it became Kohol Lavan, blue and whites, and then obviously the colors changed as well.
And they brought in Gadi Ashkenazi, another chief of staff.
Correct. So then they had the three chiefs of staff. Then when Gantz decided to join Bibi and his government during COVID in 2020, so broke off from Yesh Atid, so it became the smaller version of Kohol Lavan. Then after that fell apart, and now he went and joined with New Hope, right? So it became Kohol Lavan, blue and white, New Hope together. That's Gideon Sar's party. And now we're in the sixth iteration, which is called Machane HaMamlachti. And how are they calling it in English, Lahav?
Mamlachti is like an untranslatable word, which, you know, like I've seen entire academic studies on what it means. But if I were to sum it up in like a sentence, I would say it's sort of like a, you know, people say in America, country before party. It was sort of funny to call a party that, but that was what the meaning of Mamlachti was when Ben-Gurion, this term, was very important to him. But they've translated it into the National Unity Party,
which by the way, is hilarious to me because you remember the National Union Party, right?
Right. It's just a little bit like the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea, if you remember that joke from Monty Python. Mm-hmm. But
National Union, just to remind people, National Union was led by the likes of Benny Aloun. I mean, they were a far right party. Parts of their party were in favor of a transfer and the deportation of Palestinians, right? So National Union, National Unity kind of sounds the same.
Yes. Yes, it sounds the same. So that's also sort of funny because they're not at all like that. But then the other thing that's just funny about it is that, like, I think National Unity and party are a contradiction in terms. And just like even in Hebrew, like the word for a party, it comes from the same root word as like division. So, you know, unity and division, or
right,
just
Miflaga and Pilug. Right.
Right.
But I mean, so the question that I was wondering, so what does this mean? Like, why is Gantz jumping every few months or half a year, whatever it is? It's just a new version, right? A new party. And
I think Gantz just doesn't have a really strong political identity other than like, I'm the army guy and I always want to be defense minister if I'm not prime minister. Like, that's his whole political identity. And you kind of see it in the way people sometimes are like, oh, he could go with the moderate right. But actually he's one of the leaders of the anti-Bibi camp that wants to have a coalition with the left. And it's like, you don't really know where to pin him down, you know, and now he's been in politics for about 3 years, including some time in the Knesset, and he has a party in the Knesset. And I don't think that they're actually a right-wing party. You know, I don't think they're very far left, but like, you know, they're kind of like, pro-unions, They are, everything they propose practically involves a lot of government spending. He's blocked a lot of construction in Judea and Samaria. So I think that they're not so different from Yesh Atid, except maybe to the left of them on economics, which is like, you know, but they don't portray themselves as that. They don't describe themselves as that. So it's like this lack of political identity that allows him to just team up with anyone and change his name all the time.
Someone told me a great story recently about Benny Gantz that he met a few years ago with a head of state from a South American country, let's say. And the head of state came here and he met, of course, with Bibi, who was then the prime minister. And it was shortly after Gantz had thrown his hat into the ring and was, you know, polling very high. So was a definite contender for the possibility to become prime minister in the first election back then. And the leader of this country met with Gantz and they had dinner and started to ask Gantz, you know, so what do you think about Iran? And Gantz is, this is how it was told to me. So it had been told to someone else by, you know, someone who it had been there. So take it all with a grain of salt. But Gantz basically said, yeah, Bibi's policies are good. And what do you think about Hamas? Bibi's policies are good. And what do you think about the economy? Yeah, the government's doing a good job with the economy. So at some point, this head of state turns to him and says, so why are you running? Right. What are you running for? And I think that's kind of illustrates the problem that Benny Gantz has still today, which is, like you mentioned, a lack of a political identity. He doesn't. There's nothing that you could say, you know, I'm going to vote for him because his policy is ABC.
Yeah, he's not ideological. And I think that's OK as long as you have a plan. And I don't know what his plan is.
I don't know what his plan is. I mean, he's a nice guy. He's a mensch, right? He's not cheating people in politics, and he's not backstabbing people. At least doesn't seem like he is.
In two Gaza operations, he's proven to be a very capable defense minister.
Correct. So all that's great, but you look at the Likud and the huge turnout in their primaries, and this, you know, huge diehard support for Netanyahu despite all his flaws and his trial and the alleged corruption, and people still just clamoring for him. There's ideology there, right? I mean, it's something more than just he's a nice guy. So I don't know, and I think that Eisenkot as a result is just kind of more of the same, like another good, nice mensch chief of staff.
Yeah,
I don't know that that's what that party was lacking. Right.
He gave an interview. I don't even remember exactly when it was, but it was a little while ago. I think it was Ben Kaspit.
Ben Kaspit and Maariv. Yeah.
Right. In our sister publication. And you know, he seemed to hold kind of like left of center views on like the big issues in terms of the Palestinians, but not like very left, you know. So this seems like a good fit for Gantz, but it's like also just very vague. You don't know. You know, people really liked him as chief of staff, I think even more than they liked Gantz. But also maybe he's even less charismatic than Gantz, I would say. So I don't know what they're doing. And what's weird is also that they've brought in all these right-wing figures into the party. And I, you know, pretty publicly on Twitter really criticized Guido Tsar about this move, because I understand he needed to save himself because he probably wasn't going to pass the electoral threshold. But everything that Guido Tsar supposedly stood for in all his years in Likud, I mean, he's been in politics for like 20 years. He took a break in the middle, but more than 20 years. You know, he was against territorial concessions. Gantz is for two states,
right?
And has blocked construction in Judea and Samaria. He was very much for liberalizing the economy and free market, and so are some of the people who he brought with him in his new party into the Knesset are some of the most sort of liberal economic people in the Knesset. And Gantz's party, at least, and Gantz himself have pushed like a very pro-union line.
Also, you forgot judicial reforms, which Gideon Saar is a correct big proponent of.
I mean, in theory, though, because in the last in his year as justice minister, it's not like he did much.
No, he didn't do much, but he has spoken a lot about it. There's no way that that's going to happen in this party. But I think that, well, by the way, this party is just another example of why nothing will ever move on the Palestinian track, right? It's just another illustration of how Israel doesn't want to have to decide what to do
with
these contentious issues.
If they're saying, like, you know, nothing's going to happen with the Palestinians anytime soon, so we're able to just work together on the other issues, then they should say that. You know what I mean? Saar just joined Gantz, and I just looked at it, and I was like, well, so what does Saar stand for anymore? Or is it Gantz that's going to change? Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, they're not telling us anything.
No, you know what they stand for.
You know, we'd like to be informed voters. They stand for getting in the Knesset again.
They stand for keeping their seats, getting into the Knesset, and for the biggest, most important thing that all Israelis care about, right? Yes, Bibi, no, Bibi. I said that sarcastically, but that, like, yeah. It's I'm so fed up with this because there are such big issues and policy issues that we need to deal with, right? And no one's talking about them.
But the only person who's like, or people who are willing to stand up and say, like, could we move on and do something else, are Ayala Chaked and Yoaz Hendel, and they're not getting into the Knesset in most of the polls, unfortunately. No. They're standing up there and they're saying, we just want a government that unites, you know, a broad spectrum of political opinions. We need to stop this trap of where we boycott one another. And the voters are not flocking to them.
Right. I mean, you know, because, look, there's just not much happening. I mean, you take a look at the front page of the Jerusalem Post just on a random Tuesday this week. Housing prices have reached the highest rate in 12 years. I mean, I'd say that's a pretty big issue, right? The nuclear deal deadline has come and gone, and we still don't know what's going to happen, but Iran is still in pursuit. Netanyahu's trial is coming back. We had the IDF neutralizing a Hamas attack tunnel from Gaza, right? So, I mean, there's a ton of issues. It would be great to know what people actually think about these issues and what their policies are, but unfortunately we're still stuck in the vicious cycle of BB, can BB, low BB.
Well, let me tell you about someone who's stuck in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Itamar Ben-Gvir, sounding like his spiritual...
Our neighborhood Kach activist, yes.
Exactly. So basically, you know, he tried to sound more moderate over the years, and then all of a sudden this morning while we're recording, he sounded a lot like Rabbi Kahana, Rabbi Meir Kahana, because he said he wants to establish a ministry to encourage emigration, which is his euphemism for deporting unfriendly Arabs, basically.
Beautiful.
It's been a couple of hours since he said it, and I haven't heard anything from his potential coalition partner, so I hope that in the day and a half or so between when we're recording and when this podcast goes on the air, maybe someone will say something, because these used to be views that were unacceptable even on the Israeli right. I mean, people talk about all the time that all the Likud Knesset members would walk out of the room, when Kahana spoke. And this was Kahana's message. I mean, this was his main message, like, deport all the Arabs.
But we know that that's changed, Lahav. The Likud is not the same Likud. The Israeli right is not the same Israeli right. And definitely the Likud today, and the person who is the leader of the Likud, Netanyahu, who unfortunately cares about one thing and really in one thing only, and that's getting back into power, right? And trying to find some way to avoid the trial.
You know, the Haredim, by the way, always opposed this kind of...
Well, they don't care about this stuff. I mean, if that means getting into bed with the Kahanist... I mean,
they used to oppose it, at least. Now they're just silent.
They'll get into bed with a Kahanist. I mean, that's the least of their problems. Listen, we've lost... Okay, I don't want to sound too extreme, but we've lost a bit of our moral compass. Maybe that was too extreme.
I don't know. There's an era. It's not just in Israel. Not that it excuses it, but, you know, in the U.S., in Europe, of... populism and extremism, and it has not skipped over Israel, and it's in this case especially, it's unfortunate.
I remember coming here in the 1990s, right, and the, you know, Israel was always behind the U.S. on things like, you know, fashion, food, technology, cars. It was always like, or TV, it was always half a year to a year behind. But then when it would come here, so it would like blow up in a big way, right? If it was like the latest pair of Nikes or the newest car, or the newest TV, everyone had to have it, or like the newest food.
We used to bring them from America to our cousins, like sneakers.
Of course, but right. But then we would blow it out of proportion, right? So it would be like, it would come here, and it had already gone out of fashion back in the U.S., but here it was like we were always behind, and we took it too far. I feel like sometimes with these things, it's the same story when it comes to this new identity politics and wave of populism. You kind of waded into that a bit this week, I would say, with a big scoop that you had on involving Trump and Netanyahu, right? Two of the populist leaders.
I don't think this is about identity politics, but yes, some of the people.
Yes. So what was that story?
So for the past few weeks, there's been all these leaks from Jared Kushner's new book, Jared Kushner being the senior advisor to former President Trump and also his son-in-law. And in his book, he told, you know, of the Trump peace plan and then how the Abraham Accords happened. And the thing is, because the Abraham Accords are such a big deal, the story of the Trump peace plan, I think, got a little bit lost and a lot of people sort of forgot about it. But in these leaks, Kushner made it seem as if the idea that Israel would initially apply sovereignty or annex the settlements and the Jordan Valley was like a surprise to him. I mean, he said that Friedman, the ambassador to Israel, and Netanyahu went behind his back. A few people used the words go rogue in their headlines, but that didn't actually appear in the book. But he said that they went behind his back. Now, that seemed fishy to me in the first place. I was in the White House that day. I heard Netanyahu's briefing to the press in the Blair House right after. I read the plan, very, very long plan, you know, and I'd spoken to all kinds of people involved. And that was always the plan. The idea was that Israel would start out with annexation, the Palestinian, but would not build and would like avoid the vast majority of the West Bank, which was to become an eventual Palestinian state under certain conditions to be met by the Palestinians, including, you know, building democratic institutions and things like that. So it was strange that Kushner was presenting it something that was in the plan and also in the public speeches, like Trump himself said that Israel would apply sovereignty and then it would happen immediately. If you look at the actual facts of the matter, it seems that the disagreement really boiled down to whether Israel could have begun it within a few days or whether it would have begun in weeks or months. And the sort of smoking gun on my theory came along when I managed to get my hands on a letter that President Trump sent Netanyahu 2 days before the peace plan was presented. Mm-hmm. And in this letter, Trump says explicitly that Israel will be able to apply sovereignty as long as it accepts the plan, including the Palestinian state part of the plan. Now, Netanyahu accepted the Palestinian state part of the plan. He said so twice in his speech at the White House.
Right.
And the thing that Netanyahu was going to actually start immediately, because this was on a Tuesday, I believe, and he wanted to have a vote on annexing the Jordan Valley on the following cabinet meeting, which would have been 5 days later on Sunday. Netanyahu wrote in his letter back to Trump, according to Netanyahu's spokesman, that he would move forward on this within the coming days. That's the quote, in the coming days.
Right.
Now, I don't have that second letter, so I can only say secondhand from what Netanyahu's spokesman said. But as far as Trump knowing that sovereignty was something that was on the agenda imminently, I mean, it was there in black and white. It was in a letter that Trump signed.
And is it possible?
There's no way that Kushner didn't know about it. I mean,
it's no way that Kushner didn't know about this letter. But is it possible that the argument is more? I mean, we're getting really into the weeds here, right? And just so our listeners understand, this really doesn't make much of a difference to you, right, or to us. But it makes a difference to these people because
it makes a huge difference to these people,
right? Because there's egos involved, right? And you know that's always going to be a big part of things when we're talking about politicians. But also it has to do with a legacy and on the right wing and the people who supported Netanyahu, they were very much taken in by his promise of immediate annexation and then very upset with him when it was taken off the table. And a lot of people wondered where that came from. And based on these different versions, there's different potential culprits, but potentially it was Jared Kushner who put the brakes on this whole thing.
I mean, Jared Kushner basically admits to being the person who puts the brakes on it. Like, this is the, I went on Channel 14, which is like Israel's equivalent of Fox News. And there's like the interviewer there, Shimon Ricklin. He is someone who was upset specifically that he was upset that Netanyahu chose the Abraham Accords over annexation. Mm-hmm. What I explained to him is that when you read Kushner's book, it's very clear that once you get to June of 2020, Kushner's not happy with Netanyahu. He wanted more concessions from Netanyahu than what they had agreed on in January. Because we know in January, what Netanyahu agreed to was A, he would publicly accept that there would be a Palestinian state under this plan, which for Netanyahu is a big deal, right? I mean, mm-hmm. he's normally opposed to a Palestinian state, even though he went back and forth on it a little bit. And that he would freeze construction in any areas that are designated for that Palestinian state. So there wouldn't be any Israeli construction there. And Kushner wanted more concessions from him. It's not clear in the book what those more concessions are, but that's what he said. And then once he wasn't getting those more concessions, he said to Netanyahu, like, okay, there's no sovereignty happening. Like, we're not going to okay it. And not only that, but if you're condemned in the UN and if there's any sanctions or anything like that, we're not going to stand in their way, which was a threat, right? So Netanyahu didn't really have the option of annexation at that point.
No, and I think that really, at the end of the day, beyond these, you know, who was behind it and the ego battle here, the real question is, again, and kind of comes back to something that we're talking about, is what would Israel want to do, right? And to me, these stories really highlight a bigger problem, which is that we're constantly waiting to see what someone else is going to allow us to do, as opposed to deciding what it is that we want to do and what it is that is in our best interest as a country. This ties back to what we spoke about, I think, before, of just not having clear policies or articulating them on these very complicated and controversial issues.
Yeah. And the Trump plan was a policy, and it was a policy that I think a lot of people in Israel could have accepted. You know what I mean? Like on the right, the chances are it wasn't going to get better than this in terms of what Israel could practically do.
If he comes back, Lahav, does the plan come back with him?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, I have my doubts that Trump will come back. But if he does, he's not as buddy-buddy with Netanyahu as he was. I mean, whether justified or not, which I mostly think not, but he's disappointed in Netanyahu. And so I don't think he's going to be an anti-Israel president. I don't think he's going to be super difficult. But things aren't going to be smooth sailing the way they were in his first term.
How funny would that be? Bibi comes back, Trump comes back, and plan doesn't come back.
Yeah.
But we'll all have to wait and see. This week on the podcast, we have an interview with Ofer Gutman. Ofer is the CEO of Masa Israel Journey. It's a program that's partnered of the Jewish Agency together with the government of Israel and brings thousands and thousands of young people to Israel for different programs. We spoke to Ofer to get his read of what's happening between Israel and the diaspora, always an important topic for us, but also to hear about the new programs that are being rolled out in Masa and what they're doing. So stay tuned for Ofer Gutman. So we're happy to have with us this week Ofer Gutman, who is the CEO of Masa Israel Journey, which is basically kind of a quasi-government program in Israel. It's something that's a partnership between the Jewish Agency and the Israeli government. It brings every year about 11,000 to 12,000 young people, young adults from 60 countries around the world, come to Israel. They learn, they internship, they volunteer, they study, they do a bunch of different things. And in the last almost 20 years, 18 years that Masa has been around, 180,000 people, which is pretty astounding, have come here between the ages of 18 and 35. 30% have decided to make Aliyah to Israel. So Ofer, we're excited to have you because there's a lot to talk about. What are Masa's plans? What have they done? You can tell us a bit about the program. And also we want to kind of use you to tell us about your feelings about the Israeli diaspora divide. Some people call it rift or just relations. But why don't we start with where are we today, kind of a year after coming out of the whole COVID lockdown situation? Where do we stand in terms of numbers of people coming here and different programs that you guys have going on?
Thank you. Thank you, Yaakov. Thank you for having me. For many many of people that work in Israeli experience industry, the summer is like the busiest time. For us, where most of our people are coming throughout the school year, or the academic year, from September to the summer. So we're actually really concluding a year and preparing for our next year to come. We in Masa, we feel that Masa in English is a journey, and it's not coincidental that this is the name of the organization. We feel that this is not just a trip. When you come to Israel for a few months to a year, it is a journey. It's hopefully not a journey that's going to stop at the end of the program, but it's a journey that will have a journey with yourself, with your connection to Israel, into your Jewish identity. I mean, you come for a few months to a year, you know, you see Israel. You live in Israel. You live in Israel like locals. All of our slogan is live it like a local. We cannot put in a pinky way, in a nice way, in any way, shape or form, what we want you to see in Israel. You see the advantages, you see the challenges. You live like an Israeli. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of and the goal of Masa. And while you're here, other than the fact that you're connecting and learning about Israel, you are you are connected to the society and you're helping the Israelis understand about diaspora Jewry. So if you talk about the relationship between the Israel and diaspora, which I hope we'll speak later, for us, it starts here from a grassroots perspective. Because think about it. We have 12,000 people that come here a year. Some of them are interning in Startup Nation. They work, they volunteer, they teach English in schools in 15 cities in the periphery of Israel. And every day they are interacted with Israelis, and the fact that they're helping the Israeli society, they learn about Israel, they're connecting to Israelis, they're getting to know more about this place and about what it means for them and what does it mean to their story. But they're also sharing their stories with Israelis. I'm sure you can see from my accent that I am born and raised Israeli, and it's not surprising.
Not from Texas, no.
Yeah. So you can see, you understand that most Israelis are, when they grew up, they don't think about diaspora Jews. They don't think about Jewish communities outside of Israel. I didn't think about that at all. Only when I was blessed enough to go to, I was on Shlichut in the States, and it changed all my perspective about Israel-Diaspora relationship. I came and I thought that I'm going to teach them a lot about Israel and connect them to Israel, which I probably did to many, but I didn't know how much it's going to influence me. I think that these people that are coming here through Masa or Masa fellows, we understand in beginning, we thought they are our clients. We're understanding how much it's influenced them. But we didn't realize in the beginning, we are realizing it more and more, that they are also shlichim of their communities. They are shlichim of the diaspora in Israel. And they're changing the views of Israelis to think about the brothers and sisters abroad. So I think it's like a whole spectrum of a whole picture of the what it's giving and receiving while they are here.
So you talk about this whole spectrum. There's a really big range of programs from Masa, right? There are people who come here for like a semester of high school. There are people who come for a gap year. There are people who come really as adults to try some sort of internship or career professional training. So is the ultimate goal the same no matter what kind of program you're on?
Well, the program itself, we know that if you come for a few days or a week or two, you can pause your life and you can come here and do an organized tour or vacation and then come back to your life where they are. But if you're taking a semester or a year, it needs to, the program needs to be aligned with, first of all, your needs, your personal, where you are in life and how it's going to affect and help you. Nothing to do with Israel or with Jewish identity, how it's benefit for you. Some people, their motivation come for international experience, some for personal growth, for leadership skills, career development, academic credits, some people come here to find love. So the programs are suitable for the needs of the people. Yes, for us, we see that the connection to Israel and to their Jewish identity happens in the program, even if they're coming in the age of 18, they come to the age of 25. What they're doing that with that after, it's of course different for someone who's coming on a gap year and after that going back, going to college. We see, we hope, we know that he will be more active on campus. He will be more active towards Israel on campus. And that's something that, of course, someone that's coming here is 25 won't do because it's not his path, his life path.
Are the numbers going up in terms of participants? Have they been going down or have they been staying the same, like in terms of participants?
In the last 2 years, it's been going up, especially since COVID, which is surprisingly had a totally different impact on Masa than any other travel, because we were the, I would say, one of the only ones who can actually continue traveling. People can come to could come to Israel with Masa. We changed the program, we adopted them, we did the regulations accordingly. We have a special Masa visa because of our connections with the government and the Jewish agency. We were able to make them, to have them come here and continue the program. We also were able to vaccinate them while they were here. In many cases, they were vaccinated before their grandparents abroad. More people came, and people that it wasn't part of their life path. I would say two specific populations. One is the people who did not think about the gap year. It wasn't something that they planned to do. They were accepted to school, a lot of them to Ivy League, but because they didn't want to study on Zoom or from their parents' couches, they decided to defer and to come here. We also adjusted some of the programs that they can do the semester online, so their school abroad while they're here experiencing gap year while they're in Israel. Activities, learning Hebrew, travel around the country, meeting Israelis, doing many, many activities and volunteer opportunities. So that's one group that was dramatically increased. And the second is all of the scale of what we call Masa career programs. People come to internship, to work, to a fellowship, to courses for technology, to boot camps. It was a lot of people during COVID, the older industry went on pause, or they lost their job, and it was an opportunity for them. But we also have the long COVID effect here, because there's a lot of people who were on a professional path already, and COVID made them stop and think, well, maybe I need to restart, maybe I need to change my path. The bigger resignation that happened, we gain a lot from it, because a lot of people decided to come and explore and change their career or experience something different. And we call them the career explorers. And these two groups are really our core growth at the moment. Mm-hmm.
One of the programs that you guys have is this doctor's program. And we wrote recently, actually, in the Jerusalem Post about a decision by the health ministry to and the higher education committee in Israel to stop the basically foreign students from coming here. There used to be the Sackler program in Tel Aviv and program Ben Gurion University in Technion, because we need to open up more spots for Israelis to study medicine in Israel. And some of these foreigners were taking up those slots, and Israelis were going overseas and they weren't always coming back. This program that was started about 14 years ago, brought in because of the shortage of doctors here, was taking doctors in from the former Soviet Union. Right. So I'm curious if that's still going on, and what has the war between Russia and Ukraine, how has that impacted that program specifically, and maybe also more broadly, how has it impacted Masa?
So, yes, we are very proud of this program. It's existing, and it's bringing doctors here to young doctors to Israel. The war in Ukraine definitely impacted, as we have people coming from 60 different countries, and we have programs in different languages. We definitely have programs in Russian. And since the Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, we got a lot of new people that wants to come. We had hundreds of new people coming. To career programs, to professional development, to study Hebrew, and some of them just wanted to escape. And we try to provide the best that we can for them. I would say that we don't have programs specifically for Ukrainians. We have programs that are Russian speaking programs, and so we have in one program people from And when we say program, and they're here for half a year or a year, they're living in dorms together or in rental apartments that the program rents for them. And we have in the same apartment people from Russia and from Ukraine and from Belarus, who all of them have families and friends back home. Then until the war, they lived together, everything was fine. And then now they have this baggage, this something that's happening from between their countries. In most cases, we were very surprised that it's actually been working very well. In some cases, we need to interfere and help and moderate and bring professional help to make sure that that they can cope together. But we decided at the beginning of the war, when the decision did not change until now, it don't change since, we're not going to divide and having programs specifically for Russians or for Ukrainians. Like we do in other parts of the world, if you can cope and can continue, can learn and be in the same language, the programs are for all of you together.
So I understand that if you go by the numbers, the most resilient Masa programs are the religious programs. There's people who spend their gap years in seminary and in yeshiva. So first of all, I want to know why you think that is. And second of all, is there a greater effort to promote Masa programs to populations that might be a little bit less committed and connected to Israel in the first place, as one would assume the yeshiva and seminary students are?
So I'm happy you raised it, because it's, as you say, Masa is almost 18 years old, and this has been maybe the reality in the first years. But out of the 12,000 that we have this year, 3,000 came for yeshivas and seminaries. So it is a significant amount, but it's a quarter of our participants. The rest did not. And this is actually most of the marketing efforts and most of the new programs and products that we developing are handing towards people that are the less affiliated. And I would say that actually the ones coming to career programs are the least affiliated. A lot of them did not grow up in an organized Jewish community or did not have all the different steps of the organized Jewish community. So most of what we do to outreach are to those people, to the people that we feel, and that's, I would say, a lot of people, mainly in North America, we know that the young generation are disconnected more from Israel and from their Jewish identity. And some of the leaders of the community sees Israel as an obstacle. Some communities don't speak about Israel because they think it's something that will divide the community. And actually what we see in Masa'at, Israel is the solution. Israel is the solution to a continuation of a Jewish identity or to strength Jewish identity. Because we see it in Masa'at, we see it in all the surveys and analysts and research that we did throughout the years, is that when you come to a Masa'at program and you spend a significant time in Israel, you're much more to be towards, first of all, to be a Jewish professional, mm-hmm. to be active in the Jewish community, to engage after that, and to continue your connection with Israel. Sometimes it's actually an alternative way of a Jewish identity. Someone who doesn't want to go to a synagogue, even though it's very pluralistic, you can go to so many different streams, more and more young people, it's not appealing to them. And actually the Israel connection makes them in a different starting point to their Jewish journey.
One of the things that Birthright has had a trouble with one of their challenges has been the IFNET Now groups and some of these very extreme radical left-wing organizations that have started to protest on buses and things like that. Has Masa'at encountered anything along those lines?
When we market on campuses in North America, we have that. When we go to different conferences, sometimes we have that. But we didn't have it in our programs, mm-hmm. because our programs, look, like I said, it's easier to say, to take a stop for 10 days to come to a trip and then to do a provocative thing if you want and then go back to the United States.
It's a bigger investment to come here for a while, right?
It's a bigger investment commitment. So if they are not want to be here or they don't want to be part of it, then they won't take that that risk. Those who are coming, they're coming just because it's Israel. We have people that it's Israel first. By the way, Birthright is a great feeder for Masa'at. We have one of the best follow-ups of Birthright, and we're working very closely with them. Because Birthright is a taste, to come after that to a longer period of time, it's for those who felt that they want to experience more, it's a great engagement opportunity. But what I like the most are the ones that chose to come to Masa'at not because of Israel, but because of the program we offered. For instance, there's people who are debating between, I want to go teach English abroad. So they're looking at teach English in Korea or in Vietnam, and then they see Masa'at as well teaching fellows. And those who decide to come here because of that, I know that it's a big win, because they came because of the program. But they're going to engage with, they're going to have a connection with Israel, a strong connection with Israel. I know that, I see that. But it wasn't their motivation.
Interesting. Well, Ofer, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Keep up the good work. Definitely important to get people here. Lahav and I, big supporters of anything that helps connect Jews of the world with the state of Israel. So keep up the good work at Masa'at, and good luck with the coming year. I'm sure you got, another 18,000 people coming, so that's always going to be a challenge.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Lavin Yaakov. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. Always great to have you with us. Lav and I hope you enjoyed the show. Please find us and listen and share all over Google Play, podcasts on Apple, Spotify, you name it. Give a high ranking, 5 stars, and share with your family and friends. We'll see you next week.